Linda Simone Wastella. I'm on the faculty at the University of Maryland Baltimore School of Pharmacy. And I'd really like to acknowledge my co-authors on this paper. And it is a paper trying to make the rounds. Tammy Mark, of course, at Thompson MedStat. Dennis Shea at Pennsylvania State University. He's a colleague and economist. He's a nice guy, even though he's an economist. And my really wonderbarous graduate student, Carrie Yang, and she is someone from Taiwan, and she had to learn a lot really quick on this project. I'd also like to acknowledge Katie Levitt from Thompson MedStat, Rita Vandervoort, and Jeff Buck. They also gave me some really great comments and guidance on this study. And, of course, SAMHSA and Thompson MedStat for both the interest and the funding on this study. This study is an offshoot of the project Spending Estimates project that has been talked about up here in the front. And it was a fantastic little opportunity to actually do something that didn't involve a whole lot of numbers. It essentially meant canvassing the literature, both the peer-reviewed, the gray, the white, the brown, the purple, all the literature, that everything you want to know on mental health and substance abuse drugs and how they're used and spent. As I said, this is part of a larger project, and that's very actuarial in nature, and I was privileged to actually see some of the presentations on this project to look at what actually happened in terms of mental health and substance abuse treatment and utilization. One of the things that came out of that study is that we saw trends in treatment, and that a lot of the trends, especially in mental health, seem to be driven by prescription drugs, hence what I call the Manhattan Project. I'm reviewing the literature. It was a real joy to do that, and it was a real headache, too, because my eyes were, I found out I needed bifocals during that study. But the primary purpose of this study is to give some context about the prescription drug use in mental health and substance abuse treatment, as well as present some new estimates that came out of some IMS work that Tammy worked on and shared with me. And secondarily, to explore qualitatively factors that have the potential to influence future use and spending for prescription drugs used to treat mental health and substance abuse disorders. So this is sort of like trying to get under what's going on within the lines we're seeing on the graphs. I'm not going to spend too much. I didn't realize people here were really be covering the basis well, so I'll go through these slides pretty quickly. So why do we care about prescription drugs anyways for mental health and substance abuse disorders? Well, they're used a lot. For many MHSA disorders, prescribed psychotherapeutic agents are the predominant form of treatment. And as Steve Zubeckis at ARC has done papers on this, and he found about 8% of the U.S. population used at least one MHSA drug in 2001. And in 2005, a couple of months ago, CDC came out with some estimates using the National Ambulatory Medical Care Survey and found that, wow, antidepressants are the most commonly prescribed drug class. Fancy that. In this country. So, and the other work has shown that. For substance abuse disorders, prescription drugs are less commonly used for treatment. Part of my job is to sort of look in the crystal ball, and I think that trend is starting to change, and it will be changing more markedly for a variety of reasons. Why else prescription drugs? They cost a lot. In 2003, total mental health spending, this is just for mental health, for total health, mental health treatment in total, exceeded $100 billion. Of that, almost a quarter was for prescription drug medications. And 80% of the growth in mental health drug spending in a less recent period, 1996 to 2001, can be explained by growth in SSRIs, SNRIs, and other antidepressants. They accounted for more than half. Atypical antipsychotics, of course. The anticonvulsant mood stabilizers, which include your drugs like lamotrigine, gabapentin, topiramate, those actually have increased by 9%, even though lithium use and valproic acid and carbamazepine have remained pretty flat. And then the anxiolytics and stimulants. In 2003, total substance abuse treatment, that's not just for drugs, but the whole kit and caboodle, was about $21 billion. And of that, a small fraction, $98 million, was for prescription medications. And as we saw I think it was Tammy's presentation, I can't remember, but that looks like it might be changing with the use of a Camprosol. Okay, am I going backwards? Oh, it's the same one, okay. You don't need to know this. Wait, I am going backwards. Just hit the wrong button. I'm not used to leaning over. This study is based on the largest study, using the data sources from the Spending Estimates Project. And if you look at the percent distribution of expenditures for mental health treatment in total, you can see if you look at the biggest groups of treatment, inpatient has been slowly decreasing from about 41% to about 24% from 1996 to 2003, whereas outpatient has gone up and is sort of, you know, stabilizing at around 30%. Prescription drugs, on the other hand, really started peaking up around 1995 up to 2003. And of course, you know, that was what my original study, my little qualitative piece here, was to look at, well, why is it increasing so much? What's going on? Well, we expected that trend to continue, and so my original premise was to start looking at that trend and what's underpinning that increase. And of course, with the rest of the whole pharmaceutical industry, drug prices have gone up steadily. So we expected to continue to see those double-digit increases, right? That's what we thought. Well, if you look a little closer, and you actually not look just at the percent of total treatment, but you look at the average annual growth rates and expenditures for mental health treatment with those same categories, you can actually see that around in the three-year time period between 1998 and 2001 to 2001 and 2003, prescription drugs, which are the little red triangles, actually went down from 22.4% in annual growth rate of spending to about 10%, whereas some inpatients jacking back up again, and your outpatients about the same. So we're like, maybe there's a downshift, which is probably welcome news to most people, except perhaps the people who make the drugs. This is based on more recent data. Tammy provided me a small cut of the IMS data. It was aggregated, and I just played with it a little bit to find out what was going on in terms of therapeutic class. I'm focusing here on the mental health therapeutic classes because, you know, as other people have said here and I said before, the substance abuse treatment drugs just are, you know, just a drop in the bucket. So I'm just focusing here on mental health. But as you can see, the antidepressants, which are the bright blue line with a diamond, they took a nosedive in 2004, 2005, and are sort of creeping back up. My hunch is because people have seen the FDA safety boxes and they kind of contracted really quick and now they're starting to relax on that. That's just one of my hunches. Anticonvulsants, which include the Lamictals and the topiramates, also saw a dip and also increased. The antipsychotics kind of stabilized out. And then if you look at total drug spending, and that's for all drugs, not just mental health drugs, you can see that there's sort of a parallel dip in 2004 and 2005. So there's something going on that's affecting all of spending. There's a lot of bigger issues that might be going on, including the, you know, the impending Part D implementation, and people are just sort of like holding back before they spent to see what was going to go, but we don't know. So what will influence future trends, and what is the future trend anyways? Well, we're not really sure, but we looked at many, many different drivers, potential drivers for influencing future trends. We looked at economics and policy aspects, as well as some of the clinical issues surrounding the drugs themselves and the sort of characteristics of the drugs. We wrote 50 single-space pages on this, and I just have a few slides here to show some of the things that we thought were kind of exciting and interesting. Of course, one of the things is, how safe are these drugs? How effective are these drugs? Another potential factor is, when are these patents going to expire? When are the generics, you know, going to come onto the market? A third thing is, what's in the pipeline, which is very difficult information to get, as well as, how are these drugs being used? And it seems to be there's a trend, especially in psychiatric prescribing, for using drugs in combination as augmentation and for off-label use. So I'll just provide a little bit of evidence on each of these factors based on the literature. Drug safety is a big thing. I think every psychiatric therapeutic class and every substance abuse therapeutic class has had some sort of safety warning come down the pike in the last 5 to 7 years. The most scary ones are the black box warnings that come down from the Food and Drug Administration, and there's a lot of controversy as to whether these black box warnings actually even work. But we saw with the in terms of reducing use or causing more judicious use. We saw with the antidepressants, big black box warning with suicide in pediatrics. There's now some new studies that have been coming out showing that, yes, prescribing trends have changed for antidepressants in this population, and perhaps maybe suicide rates are actually increasing in this population because kids aren't getting antidepressants. The antipsychotics have had a few black boxes. One in particular was the advocating against the use of antipsychotics in elders who have dementia, as it has been linked with mortality and increased hospitalization. And those were focused on the atypicals, and other studies have recently come out showing that, no, it's probably the conventionals and the atypicals together. And other studies have said, no, they actually protect, so we don't really know what's going on. And then, of course, there's the whole issue of atypicals and their relationship with metabolic syndrome, weight gain, diabetes, that sort of thing. And, of course, the stimulants are associated with cardiac problems and sudden death. Do such warnings actually influence prescribing patterns? Not a lot of research has been going on. I mean, I can go ahead and tell you that every company that has one of these drugs know what's going on, but it's not actually made itself into the white literature. If I look at some marketing information and stuff that was going on in terms of market trends, we found that in one study, pediatric antidepressant new users, decreased 18% in the first quarter after the black box went in for antidepressants. Similarly, when the diabetes warning came out on the atypical antipsychotics, olanzapine use went down 3%, and that was the market leader at that time. The use of methadone, of course, buprenorphine, and other opioid agonists and antagonists for substance abuse treatment have their own abuse potential. While they don't necessarily have the black box, that is part of the reason that these drugs are not diffused and adopted widely, is because of that fear of causing their own dependence problems. How effective and efficacious are these drugs? Every drug class, and especially when you look at psychiatric and substance abuse treatment, there's people on both sides of the aisle that says, treat or don't treat, and that's a big controversy, especially when you talk about substance abuse. People who are addicted to substances often are wary, and the providers are often wary of treating them with a substance that could be addictive. We do know that as new information becomes available about the utility of specific drugs in treating problems, subsequent use and spending may be affected. One example of this is when the Katie study came out quite some time ago, actually, where they found that older, less expensive antipsychotics such as perphenazine may be comparably tolerable and efficacious as some of the newer, more expensive atypical agents. And this was interpreted by some payers as saying, hey, well, perphenazine is just as good as olanzapine or as ziprasidone. And so there was actually NIMH came out with a very strong statement saying this should not be used for formulary interpretation. It's just one piece of evidence. The SSRI and SNRI antidepressants are more efficacious than older drugs generally in treating major depression in adults. However, they may not necessarily be older than some of the older agents and cheaper agents, usually, for behavioral interventions for mild and moderate depression. Patent expiration and availability of generic alternatives. I really think that's the main thing that's driving the reduction and annual growth rates for the mental health drugs is the big proliferation of generics. The antidepressant class is almost wholly now generic. The only drug is Cymbalta, and that has pretty firm patent protection out for the next almost decade. Antipsychotics, on the other hand, that's one of the reasons they're so expensive per script. There's only, of the atypicals, which are the most widely used antipsychotics, the older conventional agents hardly account for anything. The only generic out there is clozapine, and of the atypicals, that one's used the least because of the side effect profile that it has, and it's because it's really reserved for people who are refractory to other antipsychotic use. So that class enjoys quite a bit of patent protection and will, especially since even though it looks like risperidone and olanzapine and quetiapine are coming off in the next 3 to 5 years or even 1 to 3, 5 years, there's all sorts of legal things going on and it may not happen. Regarding the substance abuse drugs, there's a lot of generic equivalents, but still because of what they are, they're just not used that much. What's going on in drug development? This is very proprietary information. Believe me, we went to all sorts of very murky places on the internet and talked to very murky people to find out what was going on. And you could go to the NIH websites, had some information. We did find that there's quite a bit going on in all these therapeutic classes. The general consensus, though, is that the United States pharmaceutical industry is in a bit of a dry spell regarding new drug development in general. And that the average cost to bring a new drug to market is almost $1 billion, which is a huge amount. And that counts for all the That accounts for all the dry holes that are done and nothing comes out of it, as well as for all that direct-to-consumer advertising. So, you know, it's a very costly endeavor. The top three classes that are most expensive to develop include the cancer drugs, the respiratory drugs, and neurologic agents. The neurologic agents include the psychiatric drugs as well as the anticonvulsants. Under development, anxiety and depression, we could find about 60 medications, 10 for anxiety, 20 for depression, and I like this, 30 for both. I mean, we already have some agents that are good at that, some antidepressants that, you know, have anxiolytic properties. There are some of these are novel chemicals, like the triple reuptake inhibitors, some of the agents that target melatonin, corticotropin relaxing factor, but most already exist. And I've got 2 minutes, thank you. I'll give you some examples. For psychotic and bipolar disorders, there's about 40 medications that are under development. Once again, these are mostly new dosage forms, or what we call me-too drugs. They're drugs that have slightly modified chemical structures that might allow them to be used in a different way, like once a day versus three times a day. And paliperidone is one. It's a long-acting metabolite of risperidone. It's just approved. And mifepristone and bupropionx. I can never say that one. Mifepristone's been on the market for a long time for another indication. And substance use disorders. Now, this is something I'm really excited about because, in my humble opinion, I think that the bench science for substance abuse is finally catching up to where mental health was about 10 or 20 years ago. And I think that's fantastic because I think with that, now there's so much neuroimaging going on. We've learned a lot from the psychiatric. There seems to be a lot of overlap in what we know about mental illness and how it works in the brain and how drugs work in the brain. We're piggybacking on substance abuse disorders for that. And I predict that there's going to be a whole lot of good stuff coming out in the market. And these are some of the things that are currently being researched at the National Institutes of Drug Abuse as well as by folks that are being funded by that group and others. And got a lot going on. I'd like to have more going on. Yeah. Real quick, off-label use and treatment augmentation. 1 in 7 medications of all types are prescribed off-label. 31% of these are psychiatric medications, and 46% of these are anticonvulsant medications. And the anticonvulsant medications are a class you really need to look out for because they're used all the time for psychiatric conditions, not just seizure disorders. Treatment augmentation is when drugs are used to boost the effectiveness of other mental health and substance abuse drugs. You see a lot of that, particularly in the treatment of things like bipolar and schizophrenia and schizoaffective disorders, and there's absolutely no evidence base to support most of this, and that's an area of research, of both clinical and other research, that needs to be increased. I'm going to give you very quick. As the last speaker, I had less time, so I'll just talk real fast. The other factors are listed here. That can, you know, influence spending and use. Of course, as we expand benefits, especially with Part D, we could possibly see an expansion in use and spending for prescription drugs. Diffusion and adoption with mental health and substance abuse treatments, it's a tale of two cities. Everyone loves mental health drugs. Substance abuse, it's almost like a stigma, and it's something that needs to be diffused, literally, in terms of our perceptions of it. The advances in basic sciences and how we understand how these disorders manifest themselves in the brain and how we can target receptors in the brain, I think substance abuse will see a huge increase. There's also changes in screening and treatment. If we get better at screening and treatment and use new techniques, we'll probably increase diagnosis. And you also have to think about advances in non-drug treatment and whether these are covered by insurers. For example, vagus nerve stimulation and transcranial magnetic stimulation are both techniques that are used to treat things like depression, refractory depression, and as these become more widely used and as insurers pick up the tab for these, they may end up being substitutes for medication or complements too. And you've heard my conclusions already. All sorts of things could happen. I don't know what's going to happen. My crystal ball got really murky on me in the end. But I think it's a fascinating area to watch, and I do predict that the mental health stuff will probably slow down a bit, but the medications for substance abuse will increase both in terms of use because of new medications that come out in the market and because of their acceptability. Yay!